Ladies, gentlemen, children of all ages, welcome to the OneLiner.com podcast, the fourth and final one from the Edinburgh Film Festival. I'm Scott Morris, and joining me is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
So, a lot of films to get through, so we will go straight into a review of Sleep Dealer. Drew, do you do the honours?
I will. In the future, the border between the United States and Mexico will be fortified with a Gaza-like concrete wall, and water will have become a privatised commodity, sold at exorbitant cost and guarded by military personnel and automated machine guns. Or so goes the story in director Alex Rivera's Sleep Dealer. Memo, played by Luis Fernando Peña, is a farm boy in a tiny town called Santa Ana del Rio, in Mexico. He dreams of faraway places and constructs a ham radio set to listen into the conversation he picks up over the airwaves, allowing him to briefly escape from the mundanity of his life. However, when he inadvertently listens into a US military broadcast, his home is targeted for destruction, the military believing him to be an agua terrorist. An increasingly large number of disenfranchised, disgruntled people across the world to resent the privatisation of their water supply. Away from home at the time, he recognises his antenna on TV, the war on terrorism now being prime-time entertainment as cameras on board remotely operated warplanes take the viewer right into the guts, quite literally, of the action. And he rushes home, but it's too late to stop the death of his father. Grieving and unable to face his family, as he blames himself for the death of his father, Memo leaves Santa Ana and moves to the huge border city of Tijuana to find work to support his family. There, he has nodes implanted in his body, which allow him to work at the Sleep Dealers, high-tech factories where third-world citizens remotely perform low-paid jobs in the first world, giving the US what it has always wanted, the work without the workers. In Tijuana, he also meets Luz, played by Leonor Varela, who supplements her paltry income as a writer by selling her memories on TrueNode, the world's number one memory dealer. Through his relationship with Luz, he discovers that someone is looking for him, and when he finally finds out who, his thoughts turn to revenge, rebellion, and how he can best avenge his father's death. The film recalls elements of the future dystopia seen in the likes of Total Recall, The Running Man, Johnny Mnemonic, though without the bad acting, fortunately, and The Matrix, amongst others, as well as Neal Stephenson's novel Snow Crash. Sleep Dealer, it paints a bleak but all too feasible near future that doesn't take much of a stretch of the imagination to picture actually coming about. It's definitely promising and a deeply interesting topic, and curiously enough, it's one of the very few films I've ever seen that I actually think would benefit from a remake. It's not something you'll hear me say often at all. A big budget Hollywood adaptation of that could actually work very well indeed, provided it was given the appropriate director. Paul Verhoeven seems the ideal choice, or perhaps David Cronenberg. Runaway screaming should the Wachowski brothers ever be connected to it. It could certainly do with some money being thrown at it. I'm as fond, or actually likely considerably fonder, of glowy blue things as the next guy, but Sleep Dealer does tend to look like they sent a production assistant down to Maplin to buy their entire stock of LEDs and disco lights. The CGI is also a bit ropey, but that's not really a criticism, it's simply an observation. The budget of the film dictates the quality of the SFX, and it being Mexican, it doesn't have a large budget. I wouldn't like you to let these points put you off, though, and don't instead wait around to see if there is a remake. Give this a go. It's thought-provoking, visually distinctive, and features engaging performances from Luis Fernando Peña and Leonor Varela. It's Alex Rivera's debut feature. It's certainly worth your time, and he's certainly somebody to look out for.
It's interesting you mentioned Snow Crash. That's just been crying out for a movie adaptation for so long. It'd probably be an ungodly mess, but goodness gracious me. It just seems like the one book we'd have read and immediately thought, this should be a movie.
Even just sort of on a basis, I like things getting blown up. stake of it, which I mean, I love things that make me think more than anything, but you know, sometimes it's just nice to have a big explosion. I want to see Reason, The nuclear-powered machine gun. But yeah, there sort of is that sort of thing, and the idea of The Running Man where criminals were turned into entertainment on TV is very like the way the military strikes and Sleep Dealer have become the prime-time entertainment. And with shows like Cops and Road Wars in Britain becoming more and more popular, none of it is particularly hard to believe. Even the huge concrete wall between the United States and Mexico is being considered for real at the moment. Mm-hmm. None of it is far-fetched at all, which is what makes this sort of film all the more engaging, I suppose, certainly all the more thought-provoking, because none of it is a great leap from where we are today.
Yeah, it's what most of the best science fiction is. You get at least one sort of big stretch of the imagination. As long as the rest of it kind of makes sense within a real-world context, it tends to get away with it. It's only when things go completely off the rails that people just start going, meh, bullshit.
Yeah, again, that's the case here. I mean, the big lie you swallow in this is the nodes. I mean, it's very Matrix-y looking, where people get nodes in their skin and computers plug into them. But you, if you buy that, then you believe the sort of outsourcing of all of the menial jobs to the third world, but in this way they found a way to get people to do the jobs without them having to actually enter the United States or whatever other country it was.
As long as it's better than The Lawnmower Man, I think that's all we can hope for.
Yes. Also, I meant to mention too, the film even manages a little bit of humour in that by the point of the future this is set in, undefined as it is, even the US State Department is using Indian call centres. Okay, and from that bleak futuristic vision, we move back to the present with a film called Bigger Than Ben, A Russian's Guide to Ripping Off London. So, Scott, what's that all about?
Well, for once, it's a London-based crime caper that can't be described as Cockney, largely because it's full of Russians, as more observant people will have noticed from that subtitle. I'll assume that didn't spoil anything for you. Spiker, played by Andrei Chadov, and Kobaka, played by Ben Barnes, head to London to make their fortune, but they soon realise that making a legit living in the city isn't particularly easy, especially for someone with no work permit or no fixed abode. Turning to the shady side of life under the tutelage of white boy Artash, the two take to shoplifting, from large chains only, of course, for moral reasons, and defrauding banks through cashing dodgy checks and the like. Daily Mail readers should rest assured, however, that they do not once prevail upon Social Security. All of the above is presented in the manner of a cheeky, chappy criminal caper movie, a la Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and the like, although things take a darker twist once Spiker decides that heroin would be a spiffing idea to escape his troubles. Like most junkies, he winds up a quivering mess, which provides Kobaka with all the motivation he needs to attempt to go straight. Now, every time I sat down to write notes for this review, I wanted to say that the sudden change in focus from bouncy, happy, amoral crime comedy to heavy-handed drugs are bad and K obviousness is the main irritation I had with the film, and every time I did that I had to stop myself. The shift in tone from dark comedy to dark, well, just dark, actually, is reasonably gradual and as close to subtle as exists in a film full of crass acts and casual racism. The perception remains, I think, because while it's trying to be funny and enjoyable, it largely works, and when it tries to be all serious, it falls flat on its face. So, being the largely positive-thinking, kind-hearted, magnanimous and humble guy that I am, I choose to focus on these happier thoughts. For most of its time with us, though, Bigger Than Ben is at the very least halfway decent. While it's not going to be winning any awards for originality, it's certainly funny enough to warrant its existence for at least an hour of its life, and while the morality tale grafted onto the back end of it is trite and redundant, it's not bad enough to warrant walking out on. The leads prove likeable enough to carry off the film, despite their actions being designed to remove as much sympathy from them as possible, and it moves along speedily enough. It never seems to drag, and for the most part it's funny and enjoyable. It's hardly life-changing stuff, and depth is pretty much a foreign concept to it, but this sentence does not seem to be focusing on those happy thoughts, so let's cut it short. Bigger Than Ben has enough merit to earn itself a recommendation, especially for those who have reached their limit of worthy dramas for the month, which I believe we most certainly have. Not a bad film by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it's certainly something I'll check out at some point, I think, Scott. And I truly have had my fill of worthy dramas.
Yeah.
So it might be a nice antidote.
Yeah, so that's at least mildly recommended. And next up, Drew, would you tell us about Idiots and Angels?
Yes, I will. Idiots and Angels is an American animation from well-known animator Bill Plimpton. The central character of Idiots and Angels is a bastard. A total unmitigated bastard. He's well balanced too. When someone takes his parking space, this most well adjusted of individuals takes a measured and appropriate response and beats said fellow up. Oh, and then blows up his car. With him in it. As I say, well adjusted. So now that he has a parking space, he can get on with his daily business, to wit, sitting in a pub all day waiting for customers to arrive to buy an illegal handgun from his dark, shady briefcase. As if this weren't bad enough, this violent misanthrope is also guilty of sexual assault as he gropes the barmaid and then straddles her back to ride her like a pony. So imagine then his shock and ours when he begins to grow angelic wings. Trying everything from binding them with chains to lopping them off with a chainsaw A reluctant Angel just cannot rid himself of these feathery appendages or their actions, and he's a reticent passenger as they perform good acts to him. There is no narrative and no dialogue in Idiots and Angels, but the beautiful flowing pencil lines of Bill Plimpton's animation ensures none is necessary. Through the drawing, the story flows from one scene to another with nuance and wit, as we follow our reluctant hero as he deals with the wings, the questions their presence asks of himself, and those who would do him harm so that they can steal his gift. Idiots and Angels is decidedly and deliberately ambiguous. There's no overarching morality message, no hard and fast judgments of our hero. Rather, Plimpton is suggesting that even the most unpleasant of characters can do good things, or perhaps that we're all innately good, or indeed something else altogether. You'll have to decide for yourself. This would of course mean you'd have to watch it, and that is certainly going to be a good thing. It's intelligent, thought-provoking, and completely devoid of carnivorous vaginas, so therefore feature-length animation for adults at its best.
Does sound good. Disappointing, I missed that actually. But refresh my memory, is Bill Plimpton the guy who was responsible for those iconic knick-knacks ad back when I was growing up?
Yes, yes, that's the fellow.
That's mainly what I will remember him for no matter what he does in the rest of his life.
Yeah, it's the same sort of animation too. It's like the distinctive pencil-drawn animation, which gives these films a very distinctive look. Yeah, mostly I made a reference to Wicked City. And it's because so much animation for adults generally means, you know, gore and sex and carnivorous vaginas.
Basically tentacle rape, isn't it?
Yes, that's about the size of it. Whereas this is, character is, as I said, an unmitigated bastard, but no, it's thought-provoking, it's ambiguous, it's a totally different type of animation for adults, and it's very well worth watching because of it.
Good, good. Better than Persepolis?
Well, as Persepolis was a bad film, and this is a very good film, certainly. Certainly it's better than Persepolis.
Excellent. Expect it to be completely ignored at the Oscars then.
Yeah, I was thinking that certainly this and the Bill Plimpton short I saw would be shoo-ins if for Oscar nominations were the Oscars actually concerned with rewarding quality.
Yes, were it not automatically going to WALL-E.
Yes. Well, if it did this time, I suspect it may not be a case of that not having the quality for it, but as we discussed in our previous podcast, we've got to wonder, what the hell are the Oscars board on?
Yeah.
Because none of it really deserves Oscar nominations at all, whereas this certainly would, but might well not even get a nomination, which is a pity. So, from animation, we move on to documentary and Werner Herzog's most recent effort. Scott, enlighten us.
For once, an award winner worthy of the name, Encounters at the End of the Earth did actually win the Best Documentary Award shown at the Edinburgh Film Festival. There is, perhaps, if you're being an asshole about it, something of the sense that Werner Herzog was invited up to the South Pole to do a film and just threw something together about whatever caught his eye. There's little, apart from location, to link his brief conversations with the scientists and technicians that spend their lives in these extreme ends of the Earth. However, the easy counter-argument to this is simply, why in the hell not just turn Herzog loose with a camera and see what shakes loose? It is hard to know quite what to make of Werner Herzog. While there's no doubting the man makes some interesting films, I sometimes wonder if we're appreciating them the way that he'd want us to. Take this year outing, for example. There were moments that sent peals of laughter through the audience, although it's in response to questions asked so deadpan, I wonder if that was quite what we were supposed to be doing. But as always, I'm getting rather ahead of myself. It follows Herzog as he's asked by the National Science Institute to head up to a South Pole base to document, well, whatever takes his fancy. What initially takes his fancy is some very pretty footage from the deep sea ice divers from the waters underneath the berg that the base floats on, but it soon turns to volcanoes and wildlife. But more frequently, Herzog chooses to get all up in the grill of people who would choose to live their lives, even in part, in a place where the sun doesn't set for 5 months of the year. The thing with Herzog, or at least my thing with Herzog, is that I find it difficult to tell if some of the questions he's asking come from a position of respect or if they're laced with sarcasm, and the poor scientists he's bothering seem equally unsure of what the chap's angle is. Imagine being, by all account, a taciturn and quiet chap who's now devoting his life to studying a penguin colony in one of the most remote parts of the world, and who even then attempts to minimise contact with these be-bothersome humans, only to have Werner pop up one day, shove a camera in your face and ask you if there are any gay penguins, and have there been any instances of penguins going insane? You would perhaps be forgiven for slugging him in the mouth. And there's a few other points where, had this been produced by anyone other than Herzog, you'd be convinced that he'd travel to an ice shelf for the express purpose of taking the piss out of a bunch of scientists and journeyman travellers who have decided to head off these white wastes. But It is Herzog, and always remember that he's only a few steps off being sectioned at the best of times, and cut him a bit of slack. I'm sure he couldn't force three zoologists studying seal physiology to lie on an ice shelf and pretend to hear seal songs, so I guess there's no harm and no foul. It's pretty funny to look at, though. If you actually need a point to exist in a film to go and see it, then this probably isn't the place to go looking. At the outset, Werner says he headed out there to answer a few questions that he seemed to instantly forget about, so that's a bit of a wash. Instead, he looks at some interesting characters and returns briefly to his favourite theme of we're all doomed to nigh on immediate extinction. Even with his best attempts to drag our spirits down, the film's infused with so much of Herzog's quirky sensibilities that it's very difficult not to walk out of this film substantially happier than you were when you walked in. It may not be the most informative documentary you'll ever see in your life, but it stands a decent chance of being one of the more interesting and entertaining ones. Go and see it if you get a chance.
That's certainly something I'll look out for. And we're all doomed. You just gotta love those wacky German nihilists. Now, this is a point I wanted to ask you about, Scott. In the press guide for Encounters at the End of the World, Hannah McGill does mention that the film moves into the analysis of the unique qualities of seal milk and the behaviour of deranged penguins. Now, it's this I wish to talk to you about. Are there deranged penguins? Are there many of them? And should there be more? Because I tend to think you can't get enough deranged penguins. I am deeply fond of penguins, and deranged ones would just up the ante.
It's a very limited form of derangement, and the actual expert in penguinology says that it's most likely that he probably just got confused and lost the sense of direction and starts running in the wrong directions. But it does, for all the world, look as though this one little penguin has had enough of life in the colony and just starts pegging it towards the mountains as fast as he can go, as fast as he can waddle. But yes, deranged penguins. Awesome.
Yes, unfortunately not enough of them by the sound of it. This saddens me immensely. You have no idea.
Next up, a fairly conceptual piece called The New Ten Commandments. Drew?
Tomorrow's 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Lansdowne Films and the Scottish Documentary Institute, with backing from the BBC, got together several filmmakers and artists based in Scotland to create this documentary, which is a collection of 10 individual short films connected by the theme of human rights in Scotland. Now, that sounds interesting, but unfortunately it is an opportunity spurned. While some of the segments managed to get the point across, most didn't manage in any entertaining or particularly thought-provoking way, and it just ended up being a bit of a mess in the end. To give you a couple of examples, one of the first sections was the right not to be enslaved, and given the problems with slavery in the world just now, something we discussed in a previous podcast talking about Eastern Promises, this is interesting, it's topical. And this is exemplified by an African woman speaking about her having been brought to Scotland as a sex slave and forced to prostitute herself with the threat of violence and expulsion from the country held over her head as a rod. And while that was quite powerful and certainly an important topic, it was rather undermined by the fact that in the same section they give examples of other prostitutes working in a Scottish city who were forced to prostitute themselves, but in this case by circumstance of needing to feed their heroin habit. While I fully believe people should be given all the help they can to get off of drugs once they've gotten on it, nobody made them take drugs in the first place. That was their own choice. And to lump that in with a woman who's actually been physically enslaved is just wrong as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's slightly misleading. I mean, once we left school, I think it was about 4 years after we left secondary school, they didn't use that compulsory take heroin day. So there is some government involvement there. Don't let them off scot-free, man.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry. I'm being very naive here, aren't
yeah,
I?
Yeah.
Though that one rather worked, a couple very much fell flat on their face. One was a piece by Irvin Welsh and the film critic Mark Cousins about the right to liberty, which was rather a disjointed look at how Scotland changed over the last 20 years, which covered a period of time Kenny Ritchie had spent on death row in the United States. And Kenny Ritchie was let off of death row, was let out of prison to return to Scotland. And if he had been improperly imprisoned, incorrectly imprisoned, hadn't had a fair trial, then there's a film perhaps to be made there, and he perhaps had suffered a miscarriage of justice. Okay. Or also, had he been guilty, then he doesn't deserve the right to liberty. But neither of these outcomes are actually anything to do with liberty. They're to do with justice, and that's not the same thing. So I'm afraid that one rather fell flat in its face. Another section, which is entitled The Right Not to be Tortured, which is very topical at the moment, and again something we've discussed recently in Taxi to the Dark Side. This decided to present the rhino to be tortured, set in Scotland as a sheep in a dark barn. And really, I'm not exaggerating here. Apart from a shot of a man's face in shadow at the start, it largely was a sheep walking about a dark barn, bleeding. And then a big pool of blood. And quite apart from the fact that this didn't seem to have anything to do with torture at all, I was watching this thinking, I didn't have any breakfast. All that sheep is doing is making me very, very hungry. Look at the delicious sheep. Fortunately, there were some more successful pieces. The most interesting, perhaps, being the right to privacy. In this case, exemplified by an animation which presented the right to privacy in one's own home by using an animation featuring a Mr. X who lived in a town that won't be named, but let's suggest it looked a bit like Air. And in this town, it was a bit like Air. Mr. X took his bicycle to his bedroom and made love to it. After the cleaning staff walked in on him and phoned the police, he was put on the sex offenders register for having made love to a bike. Now, it's quite frankly a bloody weird thing to do, but who was he harming? In the privacy of his own room, he was doing something that harmed no other human being and gave him pleasure. Yet this man, every time he applies for a job or tries to leave the country, is now going to be stuck with the same stigma as paedophiles and rapists. And it's the only people that need to fear anything from him are bicycles. And last time I checked, apart from an occasional cartoon, they didn't have minds of their own. So certainly that was a quite effective piece using absurdity to promote the right to privacy. So there were a couple more pieces that presented her case quite well, one being the arrest of a Clackmannanshire man on terrorism charges and his defence by the lawyer Amr Anwar. And this covered both the right to fair trial and really the right to freedom of expression, because it seemed to be that Amr Anwar wasn't allowed to say that he didn't think his client got a fair trial, which seems rather fascist to suggest that people can't give their opinion like that. And it's bad enough when they do it in football, but to actually do it in the court of the land is just hideous, really.
This does seem to be a film that has been hit about the head quite liberally with the obvious stick. Is there really any educational point to this film?
No, that's a disappointing thing. There are a couple of things I was unaware of, and a couple of things I said that the psycho-loving man was just an absurd story, but it helps bring the issue of the right to privacy to light. And a couple of other ones that were worthy, the right to asylum covered the dawn raids and detention centres, which have been in the news in Britain for a good few years now. But it was saying absolutely nothing new, and a lot of it was said in a not very interesting way. And that's really disappointing, but the concept sounded quite interesting, but it's failed very much in its execution.
I didn't actually see this film, but maybe you can do me the Cliff's Notes version. So torture, good or bad?
Generally bad. I think I knew that too, yes.
Slavery, good or bad?
I'm erring on the side of bad.
Liberty, good, bad?
Liberty, good, bad. I'm going to have to go for good.
Freedom of thought, expression, assembly. I'm guessing that's going to be bad.
Yes.
Yes, that's the bad, wasn't it?
Yes, halfway through, I am becoming a fascist member of the Thought Police, and yes, it's bad.
Yes, bad. That's bad, and justice also is bad. Yeah, so so there you go. We've effectively recapped everything you need to know from the new Ten Commandments there in that one sentence.
Next up is something that unfortunately we both had the delight of seeing. That's another British film called Helen Scott.
All right. While trudging out through the woods one day, 18-year-old Joy goes absent without official leave. The police find her possessions and clothes, including a bright yellow jacket, which I guarantee you will become sick of the sight of by the end of this film. As is the way with these things, the Popo decide to stage a reconstruction to help jog people's memory. They cast the quiet, unassuming and generally unhappy Helen, played by Annie Townsend, in this role. As part of the process, she meets Joy's distraught parents and decides, for whatever reason, to learn more about Joy's life, talking to Joy's boyfriends, having dinner with Joy's parents, and generally realising that Joy's life had a lot more love and happiness in it than her own had so far, and that she wouldn't mind taking the role of permanent fill-in for the absent teen. This is not, I concede, a bad idea for a film. What perhaps is a bad idea for the film is to have a character study based on someone with no character whatsoever. Townsend acts with the natural warmth and consummate skill of a slab of formica, and the only startling thing about her performance is that they've managed to find even more wooden characters in the supporting roles that make her vaguely tolerable in comparison. If you're waiting for events or revelations in Helen's character, I'd advise you take a good book and possibly a pillow, as the film's pacing can best be described as plodding or perhaps glacial. Full of exceedingly slow pans over exceedingly mundane scenes and objects, the only coherency seems to be in making sure that that damn jacket is in every single shot as some sort of garish, ill-advised motif. It's probably symbolic, not of anything in particular, just symbolic in general. So little happens in this film that it's difficult to know exactly what else to say, but let's mention this. Already this festival, I've commented on two exceedingly minimal, largely event-free films in the shape of The Red On, and perhaps more directly comparable, With a Girl of Black Soil. Not having explosions up the wazoo and the constant danger of hungry crocodiles mauling the leads is not necessarily a barrier to me liking a film, and despite similarly Spartan plotting, I very much enjoyed those two previously mentioned efforts. Helen is a kettle of fish so different that it may as well actually be a kettle of fish for all the interest it held for me as a film. With a distinct lack of a captivating and likeable, or at least interesting, central performance to hang the film on, Helen descends into a morass of boredom so dense that time actually stretches on approach to it, forming a sort of interest event horizon from which hope can never escape. The concept for this, seemingly, started out as a short film and was stretched, and boy was it ever stretched, into a feature. I think the general consensus around here is that it should instead have been shrunk into, well, nothingness, preferably. Recommended if you like boring drivel, otherwise body's worth.
If it did begin life as a short, then that was really its reach exceeding its grasp, because it just wasn't long enough for a short. There's nothing in this film, bar the director's obvious love of circular pans, which by the end of the film you will be as sick of that as you have the leather jacket. The only thing that kept me going for a while, other than my usual fallback of such dull films of copying Homer Simpson and creating my own film in my head, in this case the main character having been eaten by a crocodile, it's the only other thing that entertained me was the notion of, why would somebody buy a leather jacket in yellow? Why? Why yellow? Buy a leather jacket in yellow. This is wrong. Go away, horrible yellow leather jacket. And then I stopped thinking of that and realised the film had only been on 10 minutes and wasn't much of a distraction at all. It's certainly not something to be watched or sought out at all, and best avoided entirely.
There's possibly some promising concept in the idea of someone doing a reconstruction, you know, taking the life of the person that she's reconstructing.
Yeah.
But it's just so extraordinarily dull that, oh, jinkies.
Yeah, yeah, it's the premise didn't bother me at all. I thought, well, that sort of makes sense. I could see that happening, though. I don't think the character had a particularly bad life. It was just fairly lonely, as she would be having been brought up in care with no parents. But there was no suggestion that she'd had the sort of scary life in a care home that the papers are full of.
Yeah.
But it's just, it wasn't an interesting story. And the character had all the acting prowess of a tree.
Another one to dodge, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, I think we're very much agreed on that. Yeah. This was pish.
Perhaps not improving much in quality, but Princess of Nebraska is a film what Drew saw and will now tell you about.
Well, The Princess of Nebraska is certainly a film, and it was there on the screen, so you can probably tell where this is going. Young Chinese Sasha Ling Li, in her debut role, has come to San Francisco for an abortion. She's pregnant by the never-seen Yang, with whom she had a romantic tryst 2 days before she left China to study in America. In San Francisco, Sasha meets Bo Shen, a mutual acquaintance of she and Yang. Bo Shen, an American, has also had a sexual relationship with Yang, and it seems that he may be the reason Bo Shen was forced to return to the US and Yang was expelled from the Peking Opera where he worked. While Bo Shen has offered to help Sasha through her abortion, it turns out they may have had an ulterior motive. That is, to persuade Sasha to keep the baby to entice Yang to the US and for them to live together as a threesome and raise the child. As neither of them has had any response to Yang from the communications, it seems a forlorn hope, and on Bo Shen's part, an entirely half-hearted one, as he mentions the idea once, briefly, then lets it drop. Unsure how to proceed, Sasha roams the street, ostensibly looking for options, but more probably looking for abdication of responsibility. As she's 4 months pregnant, Sasha must decide quickly how to proceed, and the choice of whether she will return to Omaha with or without her baby is the crux of the film. And I would also like to mention at this point, in case you're wondering, that Nebraska, despite being the title, is entirely incidental to the plot and has nothing to do with it whatsoever.
And also, as far as I know, has no royal family.
No, I would imagine it would be quite well known, because it would presumably be America's only one.
Yes.
and I'd imagine we'd have heard about it. Unfortunately, there is absolutely nothing to commend the Princess of Nebraska to you or anyone else. The main character is an unlikable brat, and Ling Lee's performance is decidedly amateur. This is really all you need to know, as it's Sasha's story, and if you don't have reason to care about the main character, who's always on screen, then you're not going to enjoy the film. To add to this, the pacing is decidedly pedestrian, and despite the film covering a period of only 24 hours, there's no sense of urgency on Sasha's part. While this could be seen as an interpretation of the character seeking to delay thinking about a decision which she seems ill-equipped to make, it makes for neither an entertaining nor worthy viewing experience. However, slow as it is, the film still perversely manages to impress by coming to a shuddering halt when Sasha finally arrives for her appointment at the abortion clinic. At this point, the narrative of the film is dropped in favour of what is, in effect, an educational video about what to expect when attending such a clinic, or possibly as a staff training video for those working there. Only the fact one or two snippets of information regarding Sasha's relationship with Yang are divulged ties it into the rest of the film at all. None of it is compelling or interesting enough either to promote any sort of debate about abortion and its time limits, though to us it would make little difference anyway, given that the one-liner staff are firmly of the belief that the time limit for abortions could do with being extended by a good 30 or 40 years. Alas, another film to add to the pile of dross seen at EIFF 2008.
It sounded quite bad to me. It's directed by Wayne Yang, who has done things like The Joy Luck Club and Smoke, which I seem to have avoided completely, but were at least well-respected. But this one, I guess, not worth seeing in any way, shape or form by the sounds of it.
No, really, there's not much up for discussion here. It's simply dull and not any good. Right, that afternoon, while I stayed at home watching several episodes of The Colbert Report, you went to see a Russian film called Mermaid. Who made the better choice?
Well, this Russian film, which, again, I reiterate, I welcome seeing for further exposure to their wacky alphabet, occupies something of a unique niche as far as this year's festival coverage goes. Everything else, as far as my now addled memory allows me to be certain of, fell into one of two distinct categories. I either liked this film or did not like this film. And in a few instances, did not like this film with a vengeance. Mermaid is therefore unique in as much as I'm not entirely sure what I make of this film. The press releases seem rather keen to liken it to Amelie, which I feel compelled to correct straight off the bat. Well, actually, I can see some thematic resemblance, but in terms of quality, I wouldn't go getting your hopes up. Following the life of Ilsa, played by Masha Shalaeva, a young girl living by the sea with her corpulescent mother and decrepit grandmother. After some dilly-dallying with her life as a six-year-old, she discovers that she has the power to make her wishes come true, sort of, in one of those be-careful-what-you-wish-for kind of deals. One of the things that she should perhaps have been a bit more careful about what she wished, having now had 12 years to think about things, was about leaving her small town, as this resulted in a tidal wave that wiped out the entire town, leaving her family with no option but to decamp to Moscow. I have seemingly managed to miss out one of the more important elements of the film, which is to say that her six-year-old incarnation decided to simply stop talking, for reasons that currently escape me, but may have had something to do with her father's continued absence and her mother's forceful disabusing of Ilsa of the dream that her father will ever show up. Ilsa's dreams, incidentally, we are shown, have much the same colour scheme as the covers for Prog Rock Noodler's Yes. This is of little importance to things as a whole, but it serves as a useful distraction from my grievous prior omission. Taking a job as a giant walking foam mobile phone advertising thingy, which I believe was the exact job description, she wanders around observing humanity around her up until the point where she sees Sasha, played by Yevgeny Saiganov, taking a running jump off a bridge. Diving in after him, she drags him to safety and immediately falls in love and decides to talk again, although the love is not reciprocated. Seemingly waking up the next day, having forgotten about all of this, Sasha goes off to his day job selling plots of land on the moon, giving Ilsa a part-time job as a cleaner. The general theme of the piece is Ilsa trying to get Sasha to notice her in that special way, in the process becoming friends/enemies with Sasha's existing girlfriend, and this is largely hampered by Sasha's seemingly inherent antisocial character, or at least his deep-seated unhappiness with his life. This never really feels like the focus of the film, though, as it keeps heading off down sidetracks of her mother's attempts to get the attentions of the butcher in the supermarket that she works off, and Ilsa's friendship with a ballsy, shouty, double-leg amputee on a skateboard. Then, with little warning or sense of conclusion to the film, it ends abruptly and atonally. There's nothing much wrong with that, although it did leave me rather dazed when walking out of the cinema, struggling to try and grasp what the point of the film was. After much, or at least some, thought, I've come to the conclusion that there wasn't one, really. But there's nothing much wrong with that. Masha proves to be a charismatic enough lead, and the light-hearted, dare I say it, whimsical tone taken throughout is enough to keep a hold of your attention, albeit without ever tripping over into being anything more than something that's just keeping me occupied for a few hours, rather than, say, the enormously uplifting experiences of Amelie, which genuinely makes me glad to be alive. If you plug this into the official The One-Liner goodometer, it seems to oscillate between decent and pretty good, so, well, let's just leave it at that and get on with our business.
Okay, two questions. One, who made the better choice, as I asked you before we began? This or the Colbert Report?
Don't know, didn't see the Colbert Report.
But had I seen this instead, I probably wouldn't have been unhappy.
I believe not, no. It's interesting, and it occupies the time well enough. I don't think it's going to change anyone's lives. It's a reasonable film. It's the kind of film I'm never quite sure if it's because in the middle of a festival you're surrounded by such left-field concepts that if I'd seen this outside of a film festival I may have appreciated it more because it was somewhat unique, or perhaps I would have appreciated it less because I wouldn't have the same kind of level of tolerance to the kind of weirdy arthousey type things. So, I'm not sure, but certainly I think it's at least decent enough to warrant some attention if you ever happen across it, which, let's face it, it's quite unlikely.
Another question I have is, why the name Mermaid? I don't notice you having actually mentioned anything mermaidy in your description of the film. It's just named an affectation?
Pretty much.
I just wanted to make sure it wasn't some sort of live action adaptation of something by Hans Christian Andersen.
Next up, who wears short shorts? I don't know who wears short shorts, but I know someone who watched short films. Ah, Drew Tavendale. You went to see Idle Hands, didn't you? A collection of short films. Ah, tell us about it. Ah.
I say, we do get a lot of emails at the One Liner Podcast, and regular listener Bunty Hoven asks, did we see any short films at this year's Edinburgh International Film Festival? Well, though I didn't particularly seek them out, I did see a total of 6 in my time at the festival, and sad to say, only one of them was any good at all. First stop was Household Gods, an entirely inexplicable British short with some decidedly Soviet opening and closing music, which seemed to be about people sitting about in their flats, some of whom fell asleep. Not the most impressive piece of cinema I've ever seen, and not the most compelling ever, as I've seen people fall asleep. It happens a lot, but it's not something I want to pay money to go and watch somebody else do. Next up, though, was a real treat. Preceding Bill Plimpton's feature Idiots and Angels was the third of Plimpton's dog shorts, following on from Guard Dog and Guide Dog. Hot Dog sees our would-be heroic canine joining the fire brigade and trying some very inventive methods of putting out a fire, including something that's going to stay with me for a long time, where he cooks a sausage over the fire, allows the scent from the sausage to go up his nose to create lots of saliva, which he collects in the fireman's helmet to try and get enough liquid to put out the fire. It's funny and charming, and I'd highly recommend seeking out this and the other dog shorts in the series. Unfortunately, this upside of good shorts at the film festival was very short-lived, because finally there was a collection of international shorts grouped together under the name of Idle Hands. I'm going to drop any attempt at eloquence here and roundly describe them as pish. The first short was an Israeli effort, and possibly the only one where pish would be a bit harsh, though very dull and pointless would be spot on. Shred of Hope is the story of a worker at a printing works who returns to work every day despite having been laid off some time ago. Unable to adjust, he comes to work every day as he had done for the past 30 years, maintaining machines and showing younger workers how to do things, all without being paid. When he's finally barred from entering the factory, he's at a total loss until he finds a shred of hope that could allow him back in. Sad, certainly, and it covers a well-known phenomenon for people who have worked in one place for a long time and have to leave, but certainly not worth nearly half an hour of my time to tell. The next in this collection was definitely pish, though. Hero is about a retired man living in a hostel in an Australian city, where it apparently exists on roll-ups and breakfast cereal with tinned condensed milk. I'll give you a moment for your stomach to settle again. While out for a walk one day, he finds a mobile phone. Listening to the voicemail, he hears a message from a crazy man who has abducted the friend of the phone owner and is threatening to harm her unless his demands are met. The man decides that he should help the woman, and then doesn't. Next! Thirdly, there was Turkish short The Slope, which was the worst yet. Shot in black and white, this showed a man walking to a local hospital where he worked as a porter. At work, we saw him delivering food to patients, then transporting the body of a young woman to a fridge in the mortuary. The porter then walked back home. The end. you begin to appreciate, I am quite sure, my use of the word pish. Having endured these, you can imagine my utter delight when I realised that they had kept the worst and longest to last. This was, quite frankly, super pish. From France, Between Dogs and Wolves was the story of a man looking for a job. Seriously. Endless scenes of this man working as a pizza delivery driver at night, followed by him attending sessions during the day where people sat around and told the group leader how many people they had called or CVs they had sent out the previous day, all to be followed by him delivering pizza at night again to do the same thing the next morning. It was, unfortunately, another piece of cinema at this year's festival that had me wishing that the press passes had sharper edges so I could use mine to slash my wrist to allow me release from this tedium. Something finally happened when this man delivered a pizza to someone who had turned him down for a job, but it felt incredibly tacked on and completely failed to be shocking, as I suspect the director had intended it to be. It was mostly just surprising that anything at all had happened in any way whatsoever, though frankly it may as well not have done. So clearly, dear listener, with the exception of Hot Dog, these are to be avoided at all costs should you stumble upon them, unless you feel the need to be punished and are not to be sought out. It certainly put me off of any other shorts, which seem to be a staple of film festivals, perhaps not surprising. A lot of the point of film festivals to be showcased talent from around the world, and
yeah,
until people have seen your stuff, it's difficult to get enough money to make a feature film, which are very, very expensive to make.
Yeah.
But going by what I saw, none of them are any good, apart from the one that was from an already well-established filmmaker.
Yeah. I've always thought it's probably easier to actually write a feature film than it is to write a short. Obviously it will take longer, but at least you have time to develop characters and, you know, have a story, a plot and all that sort of thing. Whereas short films are, I've always considered them very difficult to do, because I've very rarely seen ones that are any good to the extent that I just don't watch them anymore. To be honest, if one of them does actually turn out to be any good, you will probably see it on a DVD when it's released, along with the director's first feature outing. So yeah, it's not something I go out my way to see.
Yeah, the one exception to that does seem to be animated shorts. You know, because for the longest time, animation was quite a short thing anyway, due to the time it takes to produce part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Even so, the legendary stuff that I always loved as a kid, like Bugs Bunny cartoons, all the Looney Tunes stuff, was only ever 7 minutes long.
Yeah, yeah.
Designed to be that long. So it seems to work for animation, but live-action shorts do tend to be boss.
Certainly, if you're doing any kind of drama, I think comedy gets off a little better. There's things like, what was that? What's the one that I dread to bring up? But Brett Ratner's short on top of one of the Rush Hour films with the...
The one with the little dwarf and the swords and Rebecca Gayhart in it.
Yeah,
I can't remember what that was called, but I was thinking about that just a moment ago, actually. That's when you were saying about it being on the DVD with the director's first feature.
Yeah.
That came to mind. I forget the name of it, but that wasn't bad. But yeah, it's very much the exception, isn't it?
Yeah, but trying to connect emotionally with anything in such a short film is always going to be difficult. At least comedy, you can just make a silly joke and go, ha ha ha, and move on with your life to something else. So yeah, short films and horror films, let's just not watch any of those in future.
Works for me. Fortunately, though, next we have a film that both of us managed to see and both of us liked, which is a nice change of pace from what had been happening so far. So Scott, let's fill our list on a film with me in it.
A film with me in it would perhaps win some sort of prize for least useful film title ever, although undeniably it is indeed a film with me in it, for given values of me, where me equals Mark Doherty, playing Mark, a struggling actor months behind with his rent, and in very immediate danger of having his girlfriend walk out on him. Me, in this case, also equals Dylan Moran as Pierce, an equally struggling writer/director/alcoholic, played in that typical Moran fashion. Me also equals, at least briefly, Keith Allen as Jack, their understandably peeved landlord. Briefly, because while this film seems to be setting up a low-key rom-com-like film, it abruptly jackknifes into a blackly comic farce. A set of shelves fall on Mark's dog, killing it. Almost immediately afterwards, a chandelier falls on top of Mark's disabled brother, killing him. Shocked and dazed by this, he is unable to tell Jack what's literally just occurred as he barges in to fix a dodgy kitchen light, promptly falling off a chair, ramming a screwdriver in his neck in the process, and dying. Needing some sort of solace and advice, he calls Pierce round, who immediately recognises that explaining this to the police might be difficult. But things soon get worse as Mark's girlfriend shows up on the scene, witnesses the carnage and faints, impaling herself on a clarinet stand. Corpse count 4, 3 human, 1 canine. Realising that having this many accidents occur in so short a space of time is, as Pierce would have it, taking the piss, and explaining this to the police will now be near enough impossible, the pair have to come up with some sort of way of staging this so as not to wind themselves up in jail on a triple murder charge. Perhaps surprisingly for such an extraordinarily grim setup, the film is rather deeply funny in a black kind of way. The word farce is almost offensive these days, as travesties like Death at a Funeral will attest to.
Sorry, horrible shudder there. Hang on.
But this example works in part because of screenwriter Mark Doherty's understated shell shock turn, but also because of Moran doing that Moran thing. If you're going to pick holes in this film, then you might be tempted to start with Moran's wide-eyed, dazed, punch-drunk delivery that he almost always does, and while yes, this doesn't stretch his talents to new and unusual places, this is only an issue if it ever stops being funny, and it hasn't. So shut up, theoretical critic. It's not a life-changing experience by any stretch of the imagination, but at least for those attuned to a darker comedic sense, then this is a rare treat, as while it's perhaps not as good as this year's similarly dark In Bruges, it's not far off, and is better than pretty much any example from a good decade previously. Well worth a look when it gets a full release, as I assume that it will do at some point over the next year.
Yeah, again, you mentioned the Dylan Moran thing, but I'm a huge fan of Dylan Moran. Again, I think he's going to have a movie career, perhaps something like Ray Winston, where Ray Winston in almost every film plays Ray Winston, and Dylan Moran seems to be going to play Dylan Moran in every film. But
well, it works for him, works for Simon Pegg, so
he hasn't stopped being funny yet, so why change a winning formula?
Yeah, and to be honest, the one time where he did sort of change his formula a little bit was in that Run, Fat Boy, Run, and he wasn't particularly funny in that, so, well,
no.
You dance with what brung you, as I believe the Texans say.
Yes. The other thing is, too, I mean, as the characters observe in the film, farces just aren't done anymore.
Hmm.
And there's often a good reason for it, as some of the Ealing comedies pulled it off to an extent. But since then, they're not seen, and generally because nobody can do them, whereas this one is a farce, but it is quite frankly bloody funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really enough what I say, well, this is a very funny film, go and see it.
Absolutely. Like I say, I can't think of any life-changing experience that it's not going to unveil some aspect of the human condition to you, but what it will do is make you laugh for about 2 hours, and that's all that it needs to do to justify its existence, and yeah, in this case, recommended. Something that I don't think could ever be accused of being funny, but nonetheless a good film, is Summer. Drew, would you do the honours?
If you were to mention Robert Carlyle, the chances are your thoughts will almost immediately turn to his impressive and memorable portrayal as sociopathic Begbie in Danny Boyle's Trainspotting. And I would imagine that, like me, this is where the majority of people became familiar with his name. Well, you know, apart from those who watched him as an island bobby in genteel police drama Hamish Macbeth. And let's be frank here, that show's demographic probably doesn't overlap too much with Trainspotting's audience. And, very possibly, they too, like me, have been waiting for the same level of performance from him since. Not that he hasn't been a good role since then, for example playing Edinburgh hard man John Joe McCann in the BBC's Looking After Jojo, or lawyer David O'Sullivan in the largely overlooked Black and White. But for every Phil Monty or Angela's Ashes, there's a Plunkett and McLean or 51st State, and of course that's not mentioning his two-dimensional villain in The World Is Not Enough, and the less said about the derivative Aragon the better. So it's perhaps unsurprising that I came to the conclusion that I'd already seen the best of Carlyle, and that said best was a raging psychopath. Fortunately though, Summer came along and proved me wrong. And while it's never going to replace Begbie as his most memorable role, nor, alas, be seen by anything like as many people, his portrayal of Sean is every bit as good. Sean lives with his best friend Daz, played by Steve Evans, and his teenage son Daniel. Daz is in a wheelchair, having lost the use of his legs years ago, and has liver disease to boot. Sean is his carer, washing him, cooking for him, taking him to the hospital, and even helping out with parental responsibilities for Daniel. Facing the loss of his friend after a poor prognosis at the hospital consultation, Sean begins to revisit his life and the events which led to his current situation. Why is it that this man should spend his life looking after a disabled man to whom he has no blood ties? And what is the reason for his obvious anger and frustration at the world? Through flashbacks to his younger self, we begin to piece together where Sean's life went wrong. While he's clearly far from stupid, Sean struggles to write and finds expressing himself difficult. Diagnosed with an undefined learning disability, he faces from an early age an indifferent and ineffectual educational system, unable or perhaps even unwilling to help. What keeps his adult self going though, while at the same time fueling his anger at the loss, is one sun-soaked, blissful summer. Spent in the company of his best friend Daz and his girlfriend Katie. Katie is the benchmark by which all future women will be measured, and it takes no great stretch to understand that any other women there may have been in Sean's life just don't cut it. This idyll can't last forever, though, and as his exams approach, which he dreads due to the difficulty he has with all things academic, things begin to go wrong for Sean. His downward spiral accelerates when Katie informs him of her parents' plans to move to another town. As Sean unravels, the pieces are put in place for two monumental and irreversible actions which will affect the rest of his life and give answers to the questions asked earlier. Tony Slaterling's beautiful photography bathes the scenes with the younger Sean in the warm hue of late afternoon summer sun, which adds to the already almost painful sense of nostalgia and longing for lost youth. Yet it also gives a warmth and a glow to the lives of the characters, and perhaps even a sense of hope, which isn't altogether gone in the scenes with the adult Sean. The photography, along with Kenny Glenahan's low-key direction, makes the most of the wit and pathos in Hugh Ellis's screenplay. There's a strong supporting cast, most notably the actor playing the adolescent Sean, but in the end it's Carlyle's film and his performance that ties it all together. Though he's no paragon of virtue, Sean is a complicated, troubled, yet likeable character, and Carlyle's portrayal of Sean is moving, believable, and above all real. And while it's undeniably downbeat, watching Summer is a rewarding experience, and I'm pleased to say features Robert Carlyle's best performance since Trainspotting, and as such it's well worth seeking out.
Certainly one of the favourite films from this festival. As you say, Robert Carlyle plays an absolute blinder. I was thinking about this the other day, if you start off judging a film as being perfect and then subtracting points from it, there's not really a lot that you could actually take away from it. The only thing I didn't like was the adolescent Sean. For the first 5 minutes, I couldn't understand a word he was saying. Coming from someone who has to deal with broad Scottish accents on a daily basis, this was a bit disconcerting, but he seemed to become a little more comprehensible later on. And it almost makes up for that fact by the fact that it has the single best getaway on inflatable rubber swan scene that I've seen in cinema. History.
Yeah, it almost rivals golf buggies, doesn't it?
Yes.
It's a comedy racing sequence.
There's very little wrong with this film. It is very sedately paced. Revelations are a reasonably long time in coming, but it's not like it ever feels like it's dragging or overstays its welcome. It's a very well put together film. As you say, the cinematography is beautiful. It's very well shot. As you say, the acting is blinding from pretty much everyone concerned. I can't think of anyone that annoyed me during it. Yeah, it is just highly recommended. It is a strong contender for the best film of this festival. It doesn't quite make it, I would say, which I think we'll talk about. Well, we may as well talk about it just now. There are awards during this festival. The Michael Powell Award for Best Film, Best British Film, and the Best Sort of Acting Awards, which is similarly constrained. Best Acting Award went to Robert Carlyle for this film and is definitely well-deserved.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with the exception, perhaps, of the two leads in Summerstown, I don't think anybody's come close to Robert Carlyle in this. Mm-hmm. And certainly none of the other films have been so... I wouldn't actually say quite so dependent on the central performance, because the rest of it was so good.
Yeah.
And aided by cinematography and the script. But his central performance was just so good, so sympathetic, but in no way manipulative or overly emotional. And it was just a superb performance from an actor who clearly has just been looking for this sort of role for a long time.
Yeah, something really getting teeth into it. Just felt Absolutely. Like a real character. Which is occasionally very difficult to do in cinema. There's probably some driving constraint that makes it feel, it's a film. But this one actually did feel real, and I suppose maybe it harkens back to what you were saying for the Kreutzer Sonata.
Yeah, it's something I've said a couple of films in this festival that what I appreciated so much is the realness, if that's a legitimate word to use, of some characters and sort of natural performances. I think really this year having been pretty much a bust for the most part in terms of films, and having preceded the film festival, having seen The Incredible Hulk, that I'm very much yearning for sort of genuine, believable characters and believable performances. And in some of the best films I've seen this festival, then I've certainly been rewarded.
As I alluded to, Michael Powell Award, Best British Film. Up for these, quite a few of them I've not seen, so I won't comment on, but things like Better Things, Donkey Punch, Dummy, Faint Heart, Helen, good grief, Summerstown, Stone of Destiny, Summer, Edge of Love. Of the ones that I've seen, only two that are even remotely in the league that should be called best of anything are Summerstown and Summer. And I would say Summerstown does edge it. We've discussed this previously. And of course, it, as you may see from the press releases now, it did actually win. And very deserving, I thought.
Yeah, it's one of the best films I've seen in quite some time. And again, apart from up there alongside Dan in Real Life and There Will Be Blood, two very different films. And I suppose Summerstown's different again, but quite comfortably the best films of the year.
Yeah.
And certainly the best of the festival.
I don't think I said during a podcast, but on reflection, the only thing that I think sort of sticks in my mind about Summerstown is that it may be remembered as a kind of minor work from Shane Meadows, because it doesn't have, it's simply not about the same kind of punchy subject matter as things like This Is Britain, where you're talking about sort of introducing young kids to Nazism, essentially, and sort of that it doesn't have the dramatic impact of things like Dead Man's Shoes. But I think in many ways, this is actually Shane Meadows' best film, because it is basically about two kids becoming friends, which is not the sort of thing that immediately jumps out of the page at you, but it is done so well, and it is handled so well, and it is simply an excellent film.
Yeah, and there's this thing too, what I've been saying too, is the characters and that, it's the situation, it didn't feel really contrived or anything, it just felt real and natural, and the performances were real and natural and believable. And it gets so fed up of shitty horrors and dull stuff and ridiculous glossy Hollywood stuff that doesn't actually deliver. So it's just these sort of down-to-earth, genuine people you can actually imagine meeting and talking to. It's a worthy winner, almost surprising the way that it did win, because it's not issue-led. It's just a character-driven drama, but of the highest order.
Summerstown, definitely the most highly recommended films that we'll see this festival, though of course there have been other ones that we've been very fond of. Why not check out the website? We'll have reviews up for them for your delectation. It's been a lot of fun, and with a bit of luck we'll be back next year to do the same kind of thing.
Yes, assuming we've not pissed off Hannah McGill too much.
Well, she's a big girl. She can take it. Yeah, so thanks for your perseverance. We'll be back in probably about 2 weeks with a return to our regularly scheduled podcasts, where we'll be talking about The Incredible Hulk, as alluded to earlier, and Gone Baby Gone and The Ruins, amongst other things. So hopefully you can join us then. Until then, take care.
Goodbye. I'm super happy.